Hello and welcome to the show. I am Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show. One of my favorites is on tonight, Nick Redfern, and I'm the very first interview with him about his new book. I'm always excited to do that with Nick because he has so many great books out there. The title to this book is Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, UFOs, Russian Meddling, Soviet Spies, and Cold War Secrets. And a lot of people that listen to the show know that I have a little bit of an affinity for Russia. I know Russia's been in the bad news, in a bad way in the news often, but I have gone there many times. It's an interesting culture. I've tried to research UFOs there. I'll talk to Nick a little bit about that. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. Anyone can do that. You go over to podcastufo.com. That information's there. Our blog this week is by Charles Lear, is UFOs and School Children. He discusses not only like the Ariel school incident, which many times we talk about here, but all other cases that are known with school children. There's quite a few cases, and it's really fascinating. So check that out over at podcastufo.com. And I think that may be enough for right now. Alejandro, how are you?
Yes, sir. I'm doing well. How are you, my friend?
Good, good. Welcome to the show. And so lots cooking, as we talk about every week lately. Lots going on in the UFO world. And I don't know what you want to tackle first, but have
all
at
right.
it.
Yeah, I guess I'll go down the list at the beginning of the list that you'll find of the UFO headlines at openminds.tv. Is a great story from Tyler Rogaway. So we've both talked to him, and we've talked about him because he is a defense writer in the mainstream. He writes for a site called The War Zone, and he's been writing about aerospace and aerospace technology for his entire life. And so that's why it's important for him to start writing about UFOs and getting involved in all of this. And people have been frustrated because he's been doing both. He's been talking about, you know, maybe this is some secret tech that these Navy pilots have been seeing. And he's also, however, been kind of talking with pilots and putting together the facts. So you can kind of see his mindset, how he's struggling with what the heck could this be. It doesn't seem to be our tech, but is it? And he does a great job of making the point. If it is our tech, the maneuvers and what they describe these things doing is absolutely phenomenal. So I think the more significant story he's had lately, he's had two in the last week. One of them was, well, maybe they are seeing these airborne radar reflectors. You know, certainly that wouldn't account for all of the sightings that the Navy's having, especially the Tic Tacs. However, he also got a hold of one of these pilots that was just on this latest episode of Unidentified. These pilots who were part of the Roosevelt group and 2015, the Roosevelt Strike Force, which is essentially the aircraft carrier. They were off the coast of Florida, and they saw these objects that seemed to follow them to Iran, and they saw this cube-shaped object inside of a clear sphere. He asked, you know, other pilots, is this common? You know, is this something that others are seeing? And his story was, and the headline is, recent UFO encounters with Navy pilots occurred constantly across multiple squadrons. So he found out there's a lot more pilots than just this one small group that is reporting this sort of thing. And they are across multiple squadrons, so that this UFO phenomena is affecting, you know, more pilots than just the, what have we heard, maybe four pilots so far, four or five on the unidentified television show. So I think we're going to hear a lot more about that, especially now that the Navy has changed their rules to be kind of more pro-UFO, to be more open to having their pilots report UFO sightings. So that's pretty exciting. I think that's some really good work that he does there.
Yeah, yeah. I always like reading Tyler's work. It's mm-hmm. good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to also see the process that mainstream journalism goes through, especially someone like Tyler, who's open to the idea that there is something going on here, that these pilots are, you know, accurately describing what they're encountering. And if they are, which he makes a point that, you know, they've got to be, then what the heck is this? And you see that struggle that they're going through.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. You know, both you and I have also talked to Calvin Parker, and this is pretty cool, too. Calvin Parker was part of the Pascagoula incident, which happened in the 70s, you know, where he and his buddy Charles Hickson had encountered these strange creatures. Now, he's going to be speaking at the UFO Congress. However, there has been some really pretty neat news. The Mississippi officials have commemorated his account. There's an NPR radio interview that you can listen to that we have a link to here. But yeah, kind of like Tom Reed, he's had some actual issues with this historical marker that commemorates his incident. But in New Hampshire, Betty and Barney Hills, their incident has been commemorated by a state marker. And now the Pascagoula case. So that's another important thing where kind of these historical societies across the country are open to, you know, at least making these historical markers to mark these events, or at least the occurrence of these large cultural events, even if they're UFO or alien related. And I think you'll agree that Calvin Parker comes across as very credible. This is one of the more credible cases out there.
Absolutely. And just to think that he was, I have to give credit to Michael Loke, who wrote the blog for me years ago. And basically, Calvin came out of many years of staying away and out of interviews, and he actually reached out to me initially several years ago after he read the blog, which is awesome because now he said he's only going to be doing this for about a year or so, but he's really in the limelight. And I think his timing was perfect for actually writing this book with Philip Mantle. I got those two together, and that was a big success, and he's going around the world and stuff. He's in a whirlwind because people are taking him seriously. And I think that's because things have changed in the UFO field. They're not just passing it off as, you know, a crazy guy. And he is, it is a very credible case. Good one.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, it is a very credible case. And they said that, and I'm not sure if this is the case, and as far as I know, it still is. It's after the Congress. After the UFO Congress, he's not going to be doing talks or anything anymore. He's going back to fishing.
That's what he says. Yeah. We'll see.
Full-time fishing.
Yep. That's even part of his email.
Out there in Mississippi.
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of other stories, of course, related to the Navy talking about UFOs, Congress talking about UFOs. In the last week, we've heard from a senator, Senator Warren, who's part of the Intelligence Committee, him talking about being briefed on UFOs and then why he thinks that this is serious and it needs to be taken seriously. And then, of course, the president has a little bit of a mention on ABC about all of this, which has also kind of created this media fervor, which is all still going on. So we have a lot of talk about UFOs and even some sightings of loon balloons.
Oh, yeah.
That have spawned some UFO UFO sighting reports. But, you know, as the public gets more interested in this topic, they're also going to be more interested in these cases that or these objects that often create these UFO reports that aren't UFOs, but that's going to happen. But still, we all get educated, and this doesn't account certainly for all of the Navy accounts or other serious accounts that we've heard across the along the way over the years. So it's an exciting time. All eyes are on what we do, and that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Hey, our good friend Lee Spiegel contacted me, I think it was yesterday, and about this spike of methane on Mars. Have you read anything about that?
Well, it's not necessarily, yeah, they see methane on Mars, and the latest rover is designed to detect methane on Mars, and it's in a location where there is a lot of methane. That is exciting in that it could indicate life, but, you know, I think that there's a lot of news in the astrobiological world as well. There are other indications of potential life in other areas. So, I mean, it's certainly an area to keep an eye on, but it may indicate life. It's not anything definitive. There are other processes that create methane gas, but at least this is one of the kind of hallmarks that they're looking for. They were looking to see at what concentrations methane exists, and they see it in very low concentrations. What that means to them is that there's a necessity to keep looking for potential for life. But they also make the point that this could be leftover methane from methane that was from life before. However, methane does get dissolved by solar rays, so it can't have been that long ago. But these are all the factors that they, you know, things that they think about. They can figure out how long would methane last on a planet, you know, given the deterioration and of methane. And these are some of the things that they're considering and looking at right now. But methane is another sign that there could be life on Mars today, just like we have microbes in our soil and in our rocks that could be the case in Mars.
And you have also a headline on your website about that life could have existed much earlier on Mars than on the Earth, which is pretty interesting as well. That's another good article.
That's another new discovery that they're looking at is did Mars have life a long time ago? We know now, and this used to be kind of this used to be strange to think that Mars had water or has water. We do know there is water there. I think now they even suspect there is liquid water there. The surface of Mars is not conducive to liquid water, but it could be if water is seeping out from the ground. And there's indication there could be liquid water underground. Of course, that's important to life as we know it. And they're looking at the possibility because you do see that the surface of Mars was manipulated by water, by massive amounts of water. And, you know, as much as 10 years, maybe even a little longer than that, that was kind of a crazy idea that Mars once had water. Now it's a given that Mars had lots of water like we do, rivers and streams and lakes and possibly oceans.
Yeah.
And so that maybe they had an abundance of life in the past, and it's just gone now that the atmosphere is left and the conditions have changed.
Right. Magnetosphere so, gone and everything evaporate. I'm glad we're talking about Mars with the hat you're wearing. It worked perfectly.
Yeah, perfect timing. I didn't even know you were going to go there, but this is from my Mars television series. I got that from Nat Geo, and you guys should check that out because it's online streaming. But a great show where it considers a lot of these ideas. The science behind that and behind us going to Mars. In fact, Brian Bender from Politico, who writes a lot about, you know, space and these sort of things and UFOs lately, he's in the show Unidentified. He predicted today on Twitter that we won't get to Mars till 2040. Why? This show covers a lot of it. There are a lot of considerations. So just because Elon Musk might be able to get us there in the next 10 years doesn't mean we're ready, nor does it mean that humans can survive.
Exactly.
There's a lot of stress on the human body. There's a lot we have to figure out still that we haven't. Radiation shielding, all of these sort of things. And we really haven't moved very far. So we've moved more further on the propulsion area than we have on the actual habitation area. And that's probably what's going to stall us getting humans to Mars. Even though we may have a lot more as far as probes and maybe even humans orbiting Mars in the next 10 years or so, to actually stay there for a period of time, it's going to be a little more difficult.
Yeah, there's so many hazards. It's most likely a one-way trip is the best we could do at this, you know, even in 10 years from now, probably.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, Bender predicts even when we get there, if that is indeed 2040-ish, that it'll be a one-way trip and possibly even a suicide mission.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many hazards, like you say. What fun it will be to live underground, right?
Yeah, well, that would be one potential. Actually, Bob Bigelow of Bigelow Aerospace just announced in the last week also a different system where essentially you take these fabric chutes, almost like these straws that are put together, and you fill them with regolith, and this is in the case of the moon. Essentially, you fill them with the material you find on the surface of the moon, and then you drape those over your habitats, and that protects you from radiation. So it's kind of a novel idea of how we can live on the surface. Yeah, because that's the main concern. Living underground is one way to avoid the radiation, but this is another way that could also be cost-effective, fairly simple to do, and realistic way that we could avoid the radiation.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
All right, and we'll be talking to you again next week, as always. I appreciate
it. All right, have a great show.
You bet. All right, take care. All right, everyone. So we are ready to roll with Nick Redfern. He's been on the show many times. Like I said in the beginning, he's one of the favorites here. And this time, he is going to be talking about his book called Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, UFOs, Russia meddling, Soviet spies, and Cold War secrets. He's a full-time author. I can't believe the amount of books this gentleman writes. He's always fun to talk to. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Hey, Martin. How's it going?
It's going great. Good to have you back again.
Well, thanks.
Yes. So, Nick, we don't have to go, because you've been on the show a number of times, we don't have to go into your background like we often do in the beginning of these shows here. But if you would, why don't you tell us the genesis of this book? What made you decide to write it?
Well, you know, whenever I'm writing a new book, I always try and find, you know, something that's new. You don't want to just go over old ground and recycle stuff. It's just pointless, you know. And there are so many different aspects to the UFO phenomenon that, you know, you can go in many different directions. Now, just to sort of, one of the things I talk about in the introduction of the book is how the theme of the book is how the Russians at the height of the Cold War or throughout the Cold War fabricated and created bogus UFO cases as a means to sort of psychologically sort of or at least trying to alter the state of mind of the US public and the military. And it was sort of a very bizarre set of situations. Now, I should sort of state first that before we get to the issue of the Russians creating fabricated UFO cases, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that there is a genuine UFO phenomenon. Now, I'm quite open as to whether it's extraterrestrial or if it's sort of interdimensional, multidimensional. I don't know. You know, I'm honest enough to admit I don't know what the phenomenon is or where it's from and what its origins are. But I do believe there is a genuine UFO phenomenon which has nothing to do with, you know, military experiments and things like that, even though that's a part of it. You know, there is a genuine UFO phenomenon. But what was particularly intriguing and which a lot of people have overlooked is the fact, is the fact that although there's a real phenomenon, that same real phenomenon at the height of the Cold War was sort of manipulated by Soviet intelligence as a means to create fake stories of UFOs, bogus tales of alien abductions and crashed UFOs, as a means to try and convince the United States that the aliens were communists. Now, as strange and as bizarre as that might sound, I actually managed to get a number of documents that actually confirmed that U.S. intelligence was deeply worried that if enough people read enough UFO books, like, for example, George Adamski's first book wrote, in its first print, sold 125,000 copies. And Adamski himself was a supporter of communism. A lot of people don't know that. And so there was deep concern that, you know, this guy with communist leanings was selling books about aliens who were communists as well in the figures of 125,000. And the Russians sort of followed this angle more and more as a means to try and, from their perspective, destabilize the U.S. and have us think communism is actually quite a good thing. And So that's basically the theme of the book. You know, as I point out, I'm a full-on believer in the phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon which intelligence agencies around the world have used and manipulated as a means to achieve a very different goal in many respects.
So is this more of like a Cold War thing that you're talking about? Because, you know, you think about the modern day UFOs are, you know, 1947 and after, you know, post 1947. So it's all mostly the Cold War situation.
Well, most of it is, but it does go right to the present day. I mean, the title's Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, and the subtitle will give you sort of an idea of the theme. It's UFOs, Russian meddling, Soviet spies, and Cold War secrets. So a lot of it does cover the Cold War, but in saying that, it does actually take the subject right to the present day and demonstrates that at least as late as 2018 that this research was still being done by the Russians as a means to, again, manipulate the West. Now, one of the things I should stress is that, I mean, whoever's doing this or the people who are doing this, primarily it's Russian intelligence. You know, I think one of the things that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate is that, for the most part, you know, the people in the relevant countries, whether we're entirely friendly with them or not, they're just like us. They're normal, regular people, you know, but all of us, the regular, normal people, are just caught up in this sort of mess of governments, you know, sort of going head to head. You know, actually, ironically, I have several Russian friends here in the Russian area, and, you know, they're just like us. And, of course, that might sound a stupid thing to say, but some people think, well, they're not, you know, because they're Russians, but they are. You know, they like to go out on a Friday night and have a couple of beers and hang out and have a good time.
Right.
But what it comes down to is that we're not the ones who are dictating the situation. And that goes for the same for the people in any nation, you know. The Russian people are no different to us. They're not demons. They don't want to destroy us. People in their government may want to destroy us, but they don't. You know, like us, they just want to be able to have a good life and not have to worry about mushroom clouds and radiation, you know.
Right. And like you mentioned, you know, you have some friends. Of course, I've been, my girlfriend of many years is Russian, and there's a lot of them want to come here, you know, because it's they feel it's a better life here than over there. And after spending, you know, an equivalent of, I think, about a couple of months over there, I can see why. It is much nicer here. I like being here.
My dad went to Russia about 30-something years ago on vacation and had a great time, you know, went to the Kremlin and St. Petersburg and Moscow and all over the place. And he had a really good time and you know, took a bunch of photographs. And it was far more sort of severe then, you know, as it was, as it is today. You know, but I think what all this kind of demonstrates is that, you know, whether you're born in Russia or you're born in China or you're born wherever, you know, we are really the pawns, and we can actually all sort of resonate with each other and hang out. We can talk to each other, you know, with respective languages. But it really is, you know, the governments that screw everything up. Because, you know, the Russian people are no different to us. The Chinese, you know, it's the people who pull the strings end up demonizing everything, you know.
Yeah. We have to go to break in about 1 minute or so here. So, I want to get into, you know, specifics, but keeping the 1 minute in check right here, do you want to... You want to start out by, like, what do you talk about at the very beginning of the book? How do you get...
Well, the book basically starts with U.S. intelligence. When the whole flying saucer phenomenon began in the summer of 47, they started to look into these cases and got significant rumors from the intelligence people that the Russians were working on... This is like in the really... This is just almost post-Kenneth Arnold... We're trying to find ways to use this real phenomenon and spread stories that, yes, the phenomenon is extraterrestrial. Oh, and by the way, they're communists. You know, so that was what really fired up U.S. intelligence to sort of hit back psychologically, you know, when they heard that the Russians were trying to convince the U.S. people that, you know, the phenomenon was communist in nature. And... wouldn't it be great to be a communist, you know?
How about that? Wow. Okay, so we're going to head to break. All right, everyone, my guest tonight is Nick Redfern, and we will be right back right after these messages. Hang in there.
And we're clear, Martin, and we've got 3.5 minutes in this break.
Okay, I set the timer. Thank you. All right, Nick, so during the break here, we've got 3.5 minutes. And so just keep that in mind. I wanted to ask you, what number book is this of yours? Anyway.
actually, I have to think about it myself, but it's about, it's 53, 54, 55, it's something like that. So
that's amazing.
It's thereabouts. It's the mid-50s.
Yeah. And no one that I know or have no author I've ever spoken to in the past has your discipline. And for the person that is unaware of how you write your books, can you just tell them you treat it like a job? It's fascinating.
Well, I treat it by as a job in the sense that I am kind of sort of driven in the way I work. But I wouldn't want people to think it's just a job. You know, it isn't. It's a passion and a,
oh, of course. I didn't mean it like that. Yeah.
It's like a passion. It's exciting. It's fun to do it, and you know, and uncovering information. So as long as I've got that energy and that sort of fascination and excitement for it, I'll keep doing it. But in terms of sort of how I structure the research and the writing, you know, I like to do 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, and then I've got weekends off, I've got evenings off. I never work evenings, never work weekends. Laptop shuts down at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. I don't touch it till 9 o'clock Monday morning.
And, that's amazing.
When Monday comes round, Monday morning, I do work 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, you know, and you can get a lot done.
I'm sure. You know, I don't really consider myself an artist. I'll say I'm a painter. If I'm really into a painting, I can't put that down. How do you, like, if you're really on a roll, how do you stop it at 4 o'clock or whatever it is, 5
well,
o'clock?
That's actually a good question. What I tend to do, you know, if you've got sort of 6 or 7 things swirling around your mind for that particular chapter, and, you know, it's time to finish, what I generally do is to sort of get, you know, a sheet of paper and jot down what those 5 or 6 really cool extra things I need to do to make the chapter really good. So I'll sort of make, like, bullet points, and then you know, next morning I've still got those bullet points in front of me and in my head as well, you know, so I can pick up straight away. I don't feel, you know, that I've got to keep going because I'm on a roll. You know, I wake up on a roll, so.
Well, I would say that I have more of an obsessive nature, and when I get into something, I really like to get through it. And so I can't do what you do in your work, but I really admire it. It works very well.
Well, I think thank you. Well, I think I think any kind of work in the arts, you know, whether it's poetry, painting, photography, music, whatever. I think, you know, everybody, has their own angle, you know. And I always say to people, anybody and everybody has at least one story in them that can be turned into a book, you know, something that happened in your life.
You know, I agree. We're right at our end of our break here. Okay. But I agree with that. I think everyone has a story.
We're ready to go.
Yeah, we're ready here.
Here we go.
Yep.
In 5, 4, 3, 2...
All right. Welcome back. My guest tonight is Nick Redfern. This is Martin Willis at Podcast UFO. And we were talking about, right before the break, we were talking about extraterrestrial and communism, the threat of spreading communism, which I think is fascinating. I can't believe that this was actually used as a tool. I had never heard of this before. Is this something, where did you first catch wind of this? Because I just never heard about this.
Well, over the years, I came across a few stories and snippets here and there as to sort of, you know, how the Russians were manipulating the UFO subject. Now, the reason why most people, the general public, all of us, the main reason why we didn't know was because it was being done very, very sort of deeply and secretly behind the scenes. And so they sort of, almost like a silent war was going on between Russian intelligence and American intelligence. And the average person who might have been interested in the UFO subject wouldn't have known of that aspect of it. But I often use the Freedom Information Act of a number of nations and managed to get hold of a lot of documentation showing there was deep concern, even in sort of the weeks and months after the Kenneth Arnold case in 1947, in June 24, 1947, which was the case more than any other that really gave birth to the flying saucer phenomenon. Now, through the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI, I got hold of a wad of documentation where the FBI came to believe that at least some UFO cases in the summer of 47, when it all kicked off, were actually not Russian spies, but, shall we say, people who were sort of, you know, either communists or were open to communism and were recruited by the Russians to spread fake UFO stories and to also spread the rumors that these were craft created by the Russians and that they were sort of far in advance of what we got. In other words, like a secret weapon, so to speak. And the FBI actually opened an entire file on these rumors, and they tried to track down who these people were in the United States who were sort of working on behalf of the Kremlin as a means to convince the U.S. Population that these strange things that everybody's seeing in the sky are coming from the Soviet Union, and they can outfly, and, you know, the technology is so advanced that here in the West we'd have nothing to combat them. Now, the reason why this didn't become sort of big news in terms of the media, but it did in U.S. intelligence, is because the U.S. took steps, and very understandably steps, as to why they should keep this quiet, because the last thing, you know, we just got out the Second World War, and the Russians were becoming potentially the next big enemies or foes, if you like. And so they tried all their, you know, their utmost to try and prevent the Russians from associating in the mind's eye of the U.S., to stop them, prevent them from creating a connection between UFOs and communism. But what I found, again, using the Freedom of Information Act, I got hold of George Adamski's FBI file. Now, George Adamski, for people who may not know, he was one of the earliest so-called contactees of the 1950s. Now, they were people who claimed to have had very close encounters with extremely human-looking aliens, usually, typically, in sort of desert locations, like in the deserts of Arizona, New Mexico, California, and so on. And these so-called space brothers that the contactees met, they actually sort of spouted a lot of data, if you like, and ideas and concepts that were very much communist in nature. Now, initially, the FBI released about 75 to 80 pages of material, surveillance files on George Adamski. About 3 years ago, that figure got about 250 pages. By now, today, the FBI released about 450 pages of surveillance documents on George Adamski. Yeah. And wow. most of the contactees were watched in that period by the FBI, and I've got most of their FBI files. Now, in Adamski's file, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, his first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, actually sold 125,000 books or thereabouts. Mm. Now, what happened was that Adamski was someone who, again, a lot of people don't know this, but he was someone who had a big affinity for communism. And on his lecture circuits, he would talk about how the Russians were going to dominate the world, and that it would only take a small number of atomic bombs to place the U.S. in a state of chaos. And you can understand at the height of the early Cold War and the Reds under the beds threats and everything, that kind of thing, you can easily understand why the FBI opened a file on George Adamski. But what was even more intriguing, one of the reasons why the file was opened was because on several occasions, Adamski was seen chatting at conferences and also in bars and restaurants in Los Angeles, actually talking with Russian people, apparently all about his his ability to sort of spread communism, but by doing it through like a flying saucer aspect, and that really worried the FBI. I mean, if you think about it, if Adamski's book only sold 25 books, you know, and like on a Sunday afternoon, he would put a lecture on and 10 people would turn up, the FBI probably wouldn't bother about that at all.
Sure.
But here's a guy. But here's a guy saying communism's great, and he's selling, you know, 125,000 copies of his book, and you know his lectures were jammed. They were packed with people, and so the FBI was concerned not so much about the UFO angle, but they were more concerned about how the UFO issue was being used to spread communism. And as I said, that doesn't take away the fact that there is, in my mind, a genuine UFO phenomenon, but that phenomenon in the early 50s was hijacked, if you like, by the Russians to spread the word that, you know, aren't we living in a great world, and over in the US you're living in a terrible world. That was basically the heart of it.
Isn't that something? Now, do you think that they sort of courted the UFO field or the contactee field or movement because they thought those people were more gullible and more vulnerable to change? Where do you think their reasoning was as far as targeting, you know, as far as your research goes, was it any other type of paranormal situation as well, or just the flying saucer?
No, there actually were other ones, and I'll talk about a couple of interesting ones. But just quickly, when you mentioned, you know, about you know, who gets targeted and why and so on, the interesting thing about George Adamski is that before he was actually targeted by either Russian intelligence or by people in the United States who, you know, were into communism but were U.S. citizens, basically what happened was that they targeted first people who the Russians did background checks on people like Adamski, and they basically targeted those people first because they would be the most vulnerable. So a lot of background on the part of the Russians went on to try and figure out who can we use to best achieve this particular goal. But in terms of other programs as well, which it's not a UFO program, but it does involve sort of a paranormal phenomenon in the sky, and it relates again to the Cold War in the early 1960s when Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba. Now, because, you know, Cuba was so close to the U.S. and still is, obviously.
90 miles,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, there was concern about the Russians having sort of, you know, satellite bases and things like this on, you know, on Cuba itself. Now, there was a guy named Major Edward Lansdale, and he came up with some very weird plans and projects as to how to try and destabilize the government of Fidel Castro. And one of the ideas that Lansdale came up with, and I swear I'm not making this up, but he had this plan where aircraft would be flown into the clouds over Cuba, and they would have these powerful microphones which would blast down to the ground voices saying, this is the voice of Jesus. You need to, you know, sort of overthrow Castro and embrace the world of the West. And to try and achieve that, the other part of the project was to try and project huge images of Jesus onto clouds. And so you'd have the alleged voice of Jesus, and you would have the projection of Jesus projected onto the clouds as a means to sort of convince the people of Cuba that a second coming was on the horizon, and you better come over to our side and you better do something about Fidel Castro. Now, the program was actually dropped because it was seen as just too complicated and too technical to allow it to go ahead. But this plan to sort of project not so much holograms but images onto the clouds and to blast, you know, the so-called voice of Jesus, that was the plan, and it was going to go ahead. But as I said, there were so many ifs and buts, and in the end, they dropped the program. But that was sort of one of the really alternative programs, which, as I said, it wasn't a UFO program, but it did involve, you know, like a supernatural image in the sky. And had it worked, I mean, who knows what history would it have changed it, you know.
That's right. Wow. So interesting. As far as when there the contactee movement here, was there anything at all like that in Russia? Did they have any people that claimed that they were contactees over there? Did you find any of that?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer to that question is actually no. There weren't really, in the 40s and 50s, hardly anybody in the contactee movement in Russia at that time that was really, sort of high profile or was being manipulated by the intelligence services. It was primarily in the United States, the UK, and Australia. Now, one of the more intriguing cases involves a guy named Orfeo Angelucci, and he was sort of the second level of the contactees in the 50s. When it all kicked off, we had the flying saucer phenomenon began in 47 with Kenneth Arnold. Then it was sort of around about 51 when people started to claim they'd seen these very human-looking aliens known as the Space Brothers. And without doubt, you know, whether you believe his stories or not, George Adamski was sort of the ultimate contactee. But then you had sort of like the second level, like George Van Tassel, and then you had Orfeo Angelucci, excuse me, and various other ones. Now, the most interesting story is one of Orfeo Angelucci, and he was someone who claimed to have had close encounters late at night in Los Angeles in the early 1950s. And again, the typical conversation revolved around how we should get rid of our nuclear weapons and all live together, otherwise the world's going to be destroyed and so on. And Angelucci was sort of quite inspired by these claimed encounters to go out there and sort of spread the word as to we all need to live together and the Russians aren't so bad after all. And again, kind of like Adamski, he got a very large following. What's particularly intriguing, though, is that one, by his own admission, on one occasion in the 1950s, Angelucci was essentially drugged by sort of like a mind-altering drug in the early 1950s. And as he wrote the story up himself, he was interrogated by what he came to believe was somebody in U.S. intelligence who wanted to know who these people in Russian intelligence were that had approached him and who had sort of pushed him to promote the communist angle in his lectures and in his books. You know, they wanted him to talk about communism in his lectures. They wanted to write about communism in relation to aliens in his books. And American intelligence wanted to know who it was that had hired him to do this. Now, it turned out that Angelucci actually hadn't been recruited, although American intelligence thought he had been, but he actually fought against it. He was not a communist at all, but it didn't stop the Russians from sort of clandestinely saying, hey, Orfeo, you know, you start talking about the communist side of why, you know, of the aliens and so on, you know, we'll make it financially worth your time to do so. And to his credit, you know, he backed away and said not just no, but hell no. And an extensive file was opened on him, but the FBI realized that he was really, you know, he wasn't sort of a guilty person. He was someone caught up in this strange scenario where the Russians had approached him and wanted him to promote communism from an alien perspective. And so, you know, it was a very odd period. This is still sort of 1950s, mid to late 1950s, when people like Adamski and Angelucci were being closely watched by the FBI, and equally they were being pushed by the Russians to try and influence the U.S. the population into thinking that, oh my God, you know, communism is the way of the future and it's extraterrestrial. Today, looking back, it sounds really bizarre and weird, but from the Russians' perspective, the idea was that we really can alter the mindset of the population. And U.S. intelligence was sort of, quite understandably, trying to find a way to completely obliterate this particular program. And the concern they had was that the UFO subject has a huge following. You know, it always has. Mm-hmm. But back in the 50s, you know, a lot of those books, they sold six figures, you know, regularly. And so what we today might think, well, that's like really weird, you know, trying to make the other side think that aliens are communists. But back then, it really was seen as like a viable tool, if you like, to really scare the US and the UK and Australia into thinking that, you know, yes, there's a real UFO phenomenon, but it's not on your side, you know. And it was really just all about sort of psychologically playing with the mindset of the potential enemy, you know.
Yeah. With the amount, I was just thinking of something kind of funny. With the amount of times that we've been talking about communism and communists today, and we're using Skype over phone and all that, The NSA is probably listening.
Well, hopefully I'm helping them to, you know, demonstrate what's been going on, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's I do have to say, spending as much time in Russia as I have, I did speak to a number of people, some people over there. There are some that speak English that I was able to communicate with. I don't know any Russian. I can just barely get by. But anyway, I was surprised at how many people I got into conversations and talked about communism that actually liked communism. I mean, it's such a bad word here. It's almost like, you know, the word communist and communism makes people shake in their boots. But people that I spoke to over there said, hey, you know, the food was better, and, you know, there weren't people, you know, starving and like there is now. And, you know, so I'm sure there are good points, you know, but obviously it doesn't work. It didn't work there anyway. You know, it's still ongoing in China.
And I think, you know, we can learn a lot from sort of each other's cultures. I mean, for example, you know, you can obviously tell from my voice, you know, I'm originally from England, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up in England as a kid and teenager and through my 20s before I moved over here. But, I mean, you know, for example, the British medical insurance, you know, is very different to over here. And I often see in the US that people refer to the UK's medical service as socialized medicine or socialized insurance. And just that word socialized, you know, raises the hairs on the back of people. And it makes it sound like, you know, we're all a bunch of sort of red flag waving commies, you know. Uh-huh. It's not like that at all. The medical insurance program in the UK is very different to in the US, but, you know, it's not socialized medicine, which sounds just like, you know, something that crawled out of the Kremlin, you know. It's not. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can all sort of learn, I think, from each other. Now, you know, communism does not work, you know, and I think, you know, an enterprising economy and encouraging people, you know, to get out there and achieve things in lives, you know, not just personally but also economically as well. I think that's a very good thing, you know.
Yeah. And then another thing that really grew was the black market. You know, when there's communism, there was people still making money, but not in a legal way, and that's what, there's a lot of things that grow out of that. You know, and capitalism, you know, is not fault free either. You know, we have the 1% elite and all that, you know, making more money than, you know, CEO is making 300 times what a worker makes that actually works on the product. So there is a lot of things that could be tweaked, that's for sure. You know.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I mentioned how, you know, I've got several friends who are Russians. Well, I've also got several friends who actually happen to be Russian strippers. And they make a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
they've embraced capitalism with a capital C, you know.
Yeah. Well, and, it's an interesting culture, and money is very important. Money and it's because lack of, you know, growing up in the atmosphere of lack of. So money and material is very important to to the culture. I've seen that for sure.
Yeah, and I think what's important, you know, when it comes to this issue of sort of Russian manipulation of the UFO subject, it's very easy to actually manipulate people on a large scale. You know, it doesn't take long for the sort of the whole mindset to sort of get in line when there's a threat or something, you know. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the issue of when you go to the airport, you take your shoes off. Well, you know, that was revolved around, you know, one person who had that potential bomb and issue, which actually didn't work. And yet everybody goes to the airport and without thinking takes their shoes off. In other words, you know, when something happens, we subconsciously or unconsciously get in line with it, you know, and and that's a perfect example of it. And I think that's what the Russians were hoping for. They were hoping for an assumption that would become accepted that, you know, that the aliens are here and, you know, they're on the side of the Russians. And that's why you had things like the CIA's Robertson panel, which was created in the 50s, to actually try and prevent that scenario from occurring. That the Robertson panel was this, this panel created in the late 50s, but which really came to the fore in 1953. And the CIA realized that if they didn't sort of intervene, that more and more of these bogus stories about, you know, extraterrestrial communists and so on, if they didn't stop it, that more and more people would buy into the hysteria, but without thinking about it, kind of, again, like, you know, when you go to the airport, you just take your shoes off without thinking. Mm-hmm. And so the CIA came up with all sorts of plots as a means to try and destabilize the Russians' UFO program. And I talk about that in the book, where U.S. intelligence created fake stories of crashed UFOs. They basically created fake stories saying that U.S. intelligence had got crashed UFO materials and debris and alien technology, and they subtly seeded that story into Russian intelligence to make it look like it had been stolen, you know, the data had been stolen from the U.S. And in reality, you know, the U.S. intelligence had actually created these stories to try and frighten the Kremlin, you know, the Russian premiers and so on, to try and convince them that, you know, the U.S. government had got alien technology, highly advanced technology. And so, you know, the plan was to try and frighten the Russians into thinking, you know, we'd got highly advanced weaponry that they hadn't got. So it became almost like a really weird game almost, you know, between the two to try and, you know, so who could sort of best the other, you know.
Isn't that something? So we are going into break here in about 1 minute or so. So do you think that there's any UFO stories that either side, either Russian or American, are out there that can be debunked as you know, one of these cases where, you know, they were trying to influence something that is standing that you're aware of? People call it like a UFO incident that never was?
Yeah, I mean, a perfect example is an alleged UFO crash in the island of Spitsbergen, just off the coast of Norway in the early 1950s. And it's sort of like, I guess it's like Norway's version of Roswell, you know, it's a story of a crashed UFO. Now, if you go to the National Security Agency, the NSA's website, and go to their UFO section, and they put some of their files on UFOs on their website, there's actually a section about this crashed UFO story. Now, somebody at the NSA has circled the section on the Spitsbergen case, and in big capital letters, they've written the word plant. Now, as I point, I talk about this in the book, and I point out that we could be looking at the NSA having created and fabricated this Spitsbergen story of a crashed UFO, or the NSA found out it was a Russian plant. We just don't know which is the truth. But we've got the documents showing that the NSA were clear on the fact that this Spitsbergen crashed UFO story of the early 50s was a plant. Now, this was clearly either created by U.S. intelligence to think the Russians, you know, make the Russians think that we got highly advanced alien technology, or it was the other way around. But that story, to get back to your question, that story, the Spitsbergen UFO case, is still sort of championed to this day, 70 years almost, after it allegedly occurred. And a lot of people in ufology still believe that is a legitimate case. Now, maybe it is, but when you see official documents referring to it as a plant, then you actually have to wonder, you know, was this a Russian program, or was it an American response to the Russian program?
Fascinating. Okay, we're going into the break. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. My guest is Nick Redfern, and we'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. All right, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Diana Pulsilka, and she wrote the book called American Cosmic, UFOs, Religion, and Technology. She'll be a great guest, I'm sure of it. I've heard a lot of good things about her. Also, I want to thank you for listening to the show. The two-hour full show is for subscribers at $2 or more a month, and you can see that information over at podcastufo.com. You sign up through our subscription service there. If you can't afford to sign up and you want to listen to the full shows, a little secret, all you have to do is go to our YouTube channel. That's Martin Willis Live Shows over at YouTube. And all the shows, the full shows, are over there. So the best part about being a subscriber is you help support the show. It does cost quite a bit to run this show. And also that you can run the shows on your media players, the full shows. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.